Hello, hello, and welcome once again to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, returning after Mr. Gabriel Krauser covered for me last week as I was taking time off. And thanks very much to Gabriel. Even though he had to battle the demons of technical difficulties, he did still manage to pull off a fun show. So thank you very much to him. So we're going to do another one of our more focused episodes today. And of course, we have the two big brainiacs of the Institute with us today. Head of policy research, Dr. Anthea Jeffrey. Anthea, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Nicholas. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
No, always very good to have you on the show. And from I can tell from the listening and viewing numbers that our viewers, I think, feel the same way. And Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you, sir?
I'm well, thanks. I'm not sure about that brainiac description, but we'll have to discuss that offline.
modesty is a good trait in an intellectual. Anyway.
I hit you for that one.
So let us get started with our topic for today. And as you may see from the title of this video, is Critical Race Theory, a Major Threat to Freedom or Free Societies. The IRR is putting out a report, which you can actually find on our website, irr.org.za, and there'll probably be excerpts from it being published on the dailyfriend.co.za over the coming weeks, and some campaigns around that. And this report is entitled, Critical Race Theory and Race-Based Policy, A Threat to Liberal Democracy, and it's authored by Anthea. So our head of campaigns, Gabriel Krauser, has said that he thinks that this is in many ways one of the most important things we've done recently, that it really encapsulates many of our views on evidence-based policy, on evidence-based reasoning, and on the fight for non-racialism in South Africa and the world at large. So please do go to the irr.org.za, click the reports button, and you can read it there. I'm sure you'll find it very interesting. It's a little bit long, but not too long. It's only about 30 pages or so, and I think it will give you some food for thought. I don't know, this looks a little bit like I'm doing a sort of a Mussolini pose while I talk, so I'm going to try and stop doing that. But Anthea, let's start with you I guess the basics of this report. So I think that's a pretty explosive title to people who are maybe a little bit about on the fence about this issue. Critical race theory and race-based policy, a threat to liberal democracy. Now, the IRR, largely based on work you've done, has been critical of race-based policy in the South African context for a very long time. But critical race theory seems to, it's not always clear how these things are connected. I mean, race-based policy has been with us for a long time before critical race theory was even discussed. So how do these two things connect to each other, and why should we take this so seriously? Why is it indeed a threat to liberal democracy?
Well, as you say, we've been very concerned about race-based policy for a long time, about the damage that it does. It's supposed to provide redress to the people most disadvantaged by apartheid, but it actually empowers a relative elite. It has many other negative consequences. And we've therefore been arguing for a long time that we need to shift to an alternative, which perhaps we can talk about in a little while. But in the meantime, critical race theory, which really began developing in the US in the 1970s, early 1980s, crystallized perhaps as an ideology in 1989, has moved out of where it began in academia and with some impact on the media, and has now seemed to have swept through the US and many other Western countries, particularly since the death of George Floyd in May last year. And critical race theory is important for us in South Africa because it really has many of the same characteristics as our race-based policies. And in a way, there is a historical link between the two. But to look at what critical race theory says, it says that racism is the key problem confronting the United States, and that the only way to resolve this is to bring about equality of outcome as between two racial groups. The white group, which is seen as a supremacist and oppressor group, and the black group, which is regarded as the victim group. So that's immediately enormously polarizing because there's really no room to look at the individuals within each group, people are characterized simply really in terms of what Martin Luther King might have called the color of their skin rather than the content of their character. So very divisive to have oppressors versus victims as a sort of critical paradigm for analyzing a society. And then the emphasis on equality of outcomes is enormously destructive too. Because though of course one wants to get rid of disparities on things like earnings and wealth and so on, this has to be done in the most practical and sensible and effective way. And when policy simply demands equality of outcomes, because individuals are all different, whether it's in terms of their age or their experience or their education or their values or whatever, the only way you can achieve equality of outcomes is if by giving the state enormous powers to intervene. And in giving it enormous powers to intervene, you must break with the principle of equality before the law, which is absolutely foundational to liberal democracy. And was also, of course, the foundation of the struggle here in South Africa. We wanted equality before the law, not formal statutory discrimination in favor of some. What it also means is that you have to put the group before the individual, and liberal democracy says the individual is the bearer of rights in a democracy. And the role of the state is to ensure that there is equality before the law and that the state is there to kind of hold the ring and create conditions in which economies can grow, individuals can find their path forward and cannot be hindered by the state, neither discriminated against by the state nor hindered by the state. And it's obviously helpful in a situation where you do have disparities to say, well, what are the underlying reasons for this, and then try and deal with them. And that's not an easy thing to do. And CRT just distracts attention from that completely. So, for example, we know that in the inner city areas where some Black Americans live in highly distressed and depressed circumstances, 3/4 of children are growing up without the support and the help of their fathers in the home. And whereas for whites, the statistics are very different. It's more like 25% to 30%. And this disparity in itself is enormously important in generating negative consequences for the group without fathers and more positive consequences for those who do grow up with fathers. And CRT would say it's racism even to talk about this issue because it's blaming the victim. But it's not blaming the victim. It's trying to identify what are the reasons that this has happened. Welfare policy in the US from the 1960s onwards is a key reason why this has happened. So one must be accurate in unpacking the reasons and then seeing what can be done to solve this problem. And that's a much more effective way of trying to bring about an organic move towards greater equality without empowering the state to intervene in the pursuit of an impossible goal, this equality of outcomes in every sphere.
Interesting stuff, and I agree. There's a lot of this sort of writes blank checks for politicians to start social engineering in very ugly ways, and I think the history of social engineering around the world has shown that that story usually doesn't end very well. So, Terence, let me go to you on your thoughts on this issue. But also, I was having a discussion with my dad this morning, and we were talking a little bit about how, you know, it's almost like South Africa kind of did a bit of a dry run for CRT. So one of the big ideas in critical race theory is that sort of there's this idea of whiteness, and whiteness dominates society and controls it and directs material outcomes in one direction. But whiteness is sort of like a sort of amorphous blob that seems to have no people behind it. It's just like a system. And it kind of reminds me a little bit about some of the ways that people talked about white monopoly capital in South Africa. While they did identify white monopoly capitalists during the Zuma years, for the most part, it was kind of like this amorphous blob which controlled all of society in very unspecific ways. So do you think that in some sense of South Africa were pioneers in this arena?
Well, not really, in the sense that I think that the codification of this, turning it into an ideology, required considerable sort of academic resources, and in a sense the first world problem attitude that would be prevalent on American university campuses, in the sense that academic life, and I don't mean to belittle the the academic communities. Obviously, many very good people there of various persuasions. But I do think that, that particularly in the social sciences, it does lend itself to the exploration of very fringe ideas. But, you know, having a PhD behind your name, or, you know, with the reverence that can gain you, you know, it does give you a certain amount of influence. And I think that perhaps the genius of CRT was that it just sounded very compelling, you know, particularly for a society that had very recent exposure to some pretty harsh and raw racism. You know, I mean, Anthea talks about this emerging in the 70s and 80s. You know, the civil rights was a creature of the 50s and 60s. The civil rights campaign. As far as South Africa goes, you know, I think that these things feed backwards and forwards. South Africa became in the 1980s a sort of domestic American civil rights issue. And, you know, on the show, I quite often talk about things through the lens of popular culture. I love American movies about South Africa, mostly because they can never get the accents right. And secondly, because what you often end up watching is some sort of a refracted view of the antebellum South. So, you know, there was, a movie, The Power of One, which is actually not a bad novel, but essentially it picked up things from slavery. Like it's illegal for black people to learn how to read. Complete nonsense, even in the 1940s, but that was appealing to that audience. What I can tell you, and I'm sure Anthea will remember this, I think it was 1998 National Conference on Racism, which the Human Rights Commission put on, or was it a bit later, maybe 2000? They invited Patricia Williams to come and address that, and I think this was the first time South Africa really got to see CRT put front and center, the knapsack of white privilege. I think that was their spiel. I think they paid quite a fair sum of money to come and do it. You know, which, I mean, I'm, you know, if you got it, why not sell it? But yes, you know, this started to put, with a veneer of academic respectability and the imprimatur of the South African state and its institutions responsible for promoting human rights, the idea that there are these specific privileges that adhere to whiteness, which is a concept I don't remember, you know, from beforehand. That, you know, whether you had intent or not, which is also something that I remember, you know, the speakers in the ANC were actually quite good on this at one point. That, you know, guilt involves intent. You know, for those ordinary white people who, you know, they weren't. This thing started turbocharged, and the Human Rights Commission then started to talk in terms of, well, you know, we can't treat people equally. We, you know, positive discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's kind of where it developed its dynamism in South Africa.
So, Anthea, let me get back to this question of, proponents of critical race theory will say, well, not, look, it's crazy to talk about racism as not being the central problem of South African society, because they'll say, on one hand, firstly, we have this history of racial discrimination and that requires some sort of restitution. Also in the US, the same arguments are made, but about civil rights and slavery there. But then they'll also go on to say that if you ask black people in America, in South Africa, around the world, what the biggest problem in their lives is, they will say racism, because that's what's reflected daily in their lived experience. What are your thoughts on that idea?
Well, let me focus here primarily on South Africa and on the opinion polling that we have done. Because, yes, the ANC has been arguing for a very long time that racism is the key problem in South Africa. And that's why we have to have the race-based policies, which, similar to CRT, with the idea that only the race-based policies will generate the equality of outcome that they are looking for, particularly in the form of demographic representativity, that blacks and whites should kind of fan out into the society, whether it's into jobs or into ownership deals in the BEE sphere, or whether it's land, sort of increasingly in accordance with their share of the population. And why should there be anything wrong with that, of course, is the argument. And the counter argument is that it simply ignores all the important variables which are in the real world absolutely influential. And so I talk, for example, about the fact that Black children are growing up without their parents, and that's something which immediately puts them at a great disadvantage, or many black children are. And it's a similar phenomenon that we have in South Africa. So we also need in South Africa to be able to cut through some of the verbiage and look at the problems which are actually most important in holding back black mobility. And when it comes to opinion polling, we've been asking black people what they think the most important problems in South Africa are for a long time. The first time we asked this question was back in 2001, just after that conference that Terence was referring to. And we asked it as a completely open question. At that stage, people had no idea that we were interested in race issues. We just said, first question, what do you think are the two most important unresolved problems since 1994? And people could choose anything they wanted. And it was very interesting to see how few chose racism as a key issue. That point is about 7% of black respondents. In the most recent opinion poll that we did in December 2020, which is also covered in this report we've just brought out, only 3% of black respondents identified racism as a key issue. There's much more concern about unemployment, crime, corruption, poor living conditions, and the ANC might want to say, as CRT proponents might want to say, but racism is the reason for all of those things. But increasingly, you actually stray quite away from reality and simply into the sphere of ideology in making this very simplistic assessment of everything. That unemployment is because of racism, that poor housing conditions are before racism. And this is in a situation in South Africa where for the last 27 years, we have had a black majority government with a mandate to solve these sorts of practical problems that confront black people. And they have unfortunately done a bad job, and many of their race-based policies have contributed to the problems rather than helping to make things better for the people who are the most truly disadvantaged, who are most in need of the help.
So I think we'll discuss in a few minutes, you know, how we can make things better, because I think that's a very important part of this discussion. But Terence, why has this, I mean, you said this idea was of critical race theory and racism being culprit number one, as we talk about in the report. Why did it catch on, and why is it so strongly pushed by many voices in high society, the media and culture, that racism is the problem in South Africa?
Well, I think the idea of racism, and I think far more so than any other ism, was fatally discredited by its association with Nazism. You know, and then subsequently with decolonization. I mean, these were real issues, and I don't think that one should downplay them. And I think perhaps people have an inbuilt sense of wanting not only to solve problems, but to be seen to be solving them with a particular moral virtue attached to that. You know, what could be more virtuous than standing up against the great unambiguous evil of the 20th century? Unfortunately, this I do think has created something of a Moby Dick situation, you know, where Ahab is relentlessly chasing the whale, there's a phrase that is pulled up from time to time by Malcolm X about racism being like a Cadillac. Every year you get a new model, and I think this essentially, you know, we can find virtually no examples of people using racist invective in public. We have to go after it in private, and then we have to start taking apart what people say. I mean, is there some implication there? In fact, just going back to academia, a young lady I knew about 20 years ago was invited to join one particular faculty at a local university. And one of her tasks was to conduct a discourse analysis on these issues. And she said, yeah, it was fascinating to see what people really think. And then she kind of like looked at me and like in private. Yeah, but you know, all we were doing was really twisting what they were saying to get the results we wanted. So yeah, you know, if you decide that all the stuff is there, you know, you're going to be able to find a turn of phrase, an off-color joke or something. But then again, in South Africa, you know, we have a raw recent history of this. And I think this is what gives it particular legs. You know, in South Africa, you can still find examples of raw racism. You can find examples of cross-racial hostility that, you know, may or may not be racist. And it's a sexy issue. Now, the point I always make is it's not. I think it's quite accurate to say that racism was a major contributor to many of the problems we have. It may well remain a problem now, but the question is simply flipping the script on race preferences going to help to undo it? You know, do we just use the same methodology in the hope that there's some sort of reverse gear? No, I don't think so. Problems have their historical origins. Their solutions may well be very, very different.
So let's talk about solutions, because of course our opponents will say, okay, you know, here we are pushing for things that will uplift poor people in general and black poor people specifically from conditions of hardship, poverty, discrimination, all these terrible things. What's the alternative to race-based policies? What's the alternative to government putting its finger on the scale in favor of one racial group or one identity group or whatever? Abdi, you've developed some policies which do provide solutions. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, and I think one must begin by again acknowledging the failures of black economic empowerment and employment equity, which of course are two key race-based policies here. Because what they have done is to bring benefits to a relatively small group of black people, many of them with strong political connections. But at the same time, because BEE in particular creates such barriers to doing business, it's not something that international investors have to confront in other countries. So they look at South Africa, 0.5% of the global economy, and the extraordinary difficulty of complying with rules that keep shifting all the time, and they go elsewhere. So we have less investment, less growth, and less employment than we might otherwise have. And those things truly hurt the poorest of the poor. We have a relatively small group of black millionaires, sometimes billionaires. We can think of our own president in that category. And at the same time, we have 10 million black people who are unemployed and therefore destitute. And I think even the South African Communist Party has recognized that inequality has grown since 1994. Because the gap between poor blacks and rich blacks has widened so much. So we need to do something which will reach down to the poor black people. And the first thing we need to do is encourage investment, growth, and jobs here. So we need a different kind of scorecard that will give business rewards for things like investing in the country, for helping to bring foreign currency into it, for employing people, even better for expanding the number of people that they employ, for paying taxes, which then can be used for social benefits, and for putting money into R&D and so on. So that's the first thing that the scorecard should do. It should reward business for the contributions that it makes to growth and employment and prosperity. Secondly, we must reach right down to the grassroots, to people who really are poor and desperate. And one way to do that is to say we can improve the quality of education. We're putting a lot of money into education. We're getting very poor outcomes. Part of the reason is because so many public schools do not teach effectively. And there's really a global movement around the world in developing countries where poor parents are voting with their children's feet, taking them out of free, bad public schools and putting them into low-cost, much better private schools. And that's an initiative which we could replicate here in South Africa, and we could make it possible for many more parents to avoid that. If we took some of the education budget and we transferred it into education schooling vouchers for poor parents, people who would be chosen on a means test because they're disadvantaged in that way, not because of their race. We happen to know that they'd still be 99% black, but they'd be chosen on a means test, which takes some of the stigma out of the racial divisions that we otherwise foster. And then schools would have to compete for their custom. They'd be voucher-bearing parents, and the schools would need to satisfy them that they can do a good enough job. It changes the whole balance of power. It empowers those families directly. And this is the experience in other countries. It's what we need to achieve here. And an empowerment system which included this emphasis for business on growth and jobs and at the grassroots level on what would really help people climb the economic ladder, like school vouchers or vouchers for vocational training or some sort of adult education for those who really missed the boat on schooling. That would make a real difference in giving people the skills to participate in a growing economy.
So a politician or an activist watching this might say, well, that sounds good, but these things, they just aren't popular. You know, we're not really going to be able to build support behind these. And even though, as you say, you know, most Black South Africans don't think that racism is the big problem, that the sort of redistributive race-based framework is very popular and can never be overturned by a sort of, you know, democratic politician. What's your thoughts on that, Anthea?
Well, fortunately, again, we have opinion polling, which where we probe precisely these issues. And we've asked people whether what is the best way, what is the best thing that the government can do to help them get ahead? Is it through more employment equity and BEE, or is it through policies that promote growth, jobs, and good skills? And more than 70% say the latter, 4% say more employment equity and BEE. And when we asked them if they would be interested in education vouchers, for example, 80% of Black respondents in this last survey, yes, said they would. And 3/4 of Black respondents said that these vouchers would be more helpful to them than BEE in helping them to get ahead. So I think ordinary people do have a good understanding of what works and what doesn't. They know they're excluded from BEE, and they are really very anxious to have an alternative approach that would reach down to the grassroots and make a difference in their own lives.
Right, right, definitely. As I'm sure this is not an original sentiment at all, but I think the lesson of South Africa over the last couple of years has been, as they say, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expect a different result. And the ANC and much of the intelligentsia has very much been using the sort of race-based tool over and over again and expecting every time that it's going to work, no matter how much they double down on it. And as we've seen, it is not, especially over the last 10 years. So let me go, Terence, in 60 seconds or so, your final thoughts on this topic, and then we'll close up the episode.
Well, I think that there's a supreme irony to this, that one thing that the post-apartheid government has done that has actually really ameliorated poverty is the social grant system, which is one thing that which is actually means tested. There are some poor white people who receive it, and this, interestingly enough, is kind of sacrosanct amongst many, let's say, activists on the left. Why they find it so difficult to make a leap from that into broader policy, I don't know. It's it really is quite remarkable. But, you know, for all of its weaknesses and issues of sustainability, this has actually given millions of poor people a lifeline, and we need to explore that line of policy reasoning in other directions.
Interesting stuff. Yeah, no, that's a very good point about this sort of blindness and almost faith-based approach to people's belief in race-based policies. Anyway, this is, of course, a very big topic, and we can go on about this for ages and ages. I do encourage everyone to read the report. It goes into some of the things we talked about here in much more detail, and it explains additional problems with BEE and why it doesn't work and will never work, and that you can find the report on irr.org.za, and if you click the Reports tab at the bottom, it'll be the most recent report. So anyway, thank you very much to Anthea and Terence for coming on today. This is just a bit of a taste. There'll be more coming from us in the next few weeks. You'll see us also in the media talking about this report and our solutions for South Africa and indeed many countries' problems, because I think a lot of these ideas would translate to other places. And if you want to support the IRR's efforts to fight against critical race theory, to fight against race-based policy, and to support non-racialism and evidence-based policy, please SMS your name to, it's on the banner behind me, although my head is blocking it, 32823, and we'll call you back and sign you up as a donor of the IRR. Anyway, thank you very much. Have a wonderful week, and we will see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.